spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
The Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, April 29th, 2015, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. So glad you could join us, no matter how you're listening to us. You can listen to us online at 420radio.org. You can listen to us on podcast, on iTunes and Stitcher. But the way you really should be listening to us is on the new 420 Radio app. It's available now for your Android phone. If you go to 420radio.buzz, you can go straight to the download page. And yes, iPhone users, we are working on the iPhone version. It should be available very soon, and we'll get you downloaded that way. But you can take 420 Radio with you on the go, 24-hour access to live replays of the best marijuana podcasts and news shows all throughout the United States and the rest of the world. We're adding new shows every month, and this month we've got another brand new show. You heard me on it yesterday. Steve Green produces a daily marijuana show called The Full Melt. You can find them at thefullmelt.com, and we're going to be adding him to the 420 Radio lineup starting Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. Every weekday, a brand new show. Boy, I'll tell you, folks, I've been doing this for a while, and I know how difficult it is to put together a daily show on marijuana news affairs. Steve Green's doing a great job. I've seen his previous shows and his lineup. He's gotten some great interviews as well. Looking forward to adding The Full Melt to our regular daily lineup. Also, we have pruned the lineup just a little bit, removed some shows that are no longer in production, and rearranged some of the shows. So if you're used to listening to certain replays at certain times, you're going to want to check the 420radio.org/schedule page so that you can find out when your shows are replaying. Every show now gets four replays on 420 Radio's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week schedule. There's a replay in the time zone for you, whether you're a morning person, an afternoon person, an evening person, or a late night person, you'll find a replay time for you. All right, coming up on today's show, all sorts of great stuff to get to. We got an interview coming up at 1:30 with Jamie Shaw. He's from Vancouver, British Columbia's BC Compassion Club. We're going to talk about the fight to legalize marijuana in Vancouver, including a recent push to legalize the dispensaries that are obviously already in existence. Then we'll have some time for a radical rant, and we're taking a look at Baltimore, where the city is in flames following the death in police custody of Freddie Gray. Neil Franklin from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition has been on a lot of the cable shows, as he was a police commander, a major there in Baltimore for many years. And we're going to talk more about how you cannot end these kinds of racial and civil unrest situations without ending the war on drugs. It's something I wrote about for High Times in the most recent issue, Prohibition, the Legacy of Racism, and we're going to discuss it more today because it looks like more and more of the mainstream talking heads, including people like Hillary Clinton, are recognizing the nexus between the war on drugs and this civil unrest and abuse of police powers. Also coming up on the show today, in the drug war data mines, there's a report out from Forbes magazine about exactly how much money, welfare money that is being spent at Colorado pot shops. And I'll make the argument for why we shouldn't give a shit. Also coming up in Behind the Headlines here in Oregon, we talked about this on the show yesterday, a bill that is being amended to decimate some of the grow rights in medical marijuana here in the Beaver State. Now there's amendments to the amendments. I'm going to break those down for you, give you an idea what the hell is going on here in Oregon. But of course, we start things off with the 420 Radio News. Plenty of headlines, including a new bill in the House to allow banking. We got stories from Louisiana, Nebraska, Ohio, and Michigan, all coming up right after these sponsor messages. Stay tuned. It's the Russ Belville Show.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio, your ticket to Seattle Hemp Fest.
Are you tired of storing your herb in back alley baggies? Then keep your herb fresh and protected with Pottles. Pottles are airtight and odor-free, not to mention they're reusable, BPA-free, and UV-resistant. Pottles come in a variety of sizes, styles, and colors, so go check out Pottles at mypottles.com. Use the code STASH to get an additional 10% off. Again, that's mypottles.com, mypottles.com, and tell them Radical Russ sent ya.
Oh man, I really dig this tune. You should really check out this groove.
Cool.
Hey, check out more deep cuts like this on my show, Big Daddy Fink's Funky Roller Rink, every Thursday night on 420 Radio.
Funky Roller Rink.
Radio is brought to you by Sacred Serum, who is focused on creating elegant and sophisticated cannabis solutions through its line of dispensers and vaporizers that come preloaded with the world's finest cannabis concentrate. Sacred Serum's concentrate is made on pharmaceutical-grade supercritical CO2 extraction machines that use absolutely no butane or other toxic chemicals. The Vesica, the company's innovative new way to dab and frost, is now available in dispensaries across California. Sacred Serum. Elegance and sophistication concentrated.
It's time for the 420 Radio News, covering the latest headlines in consumer cannabis, medical marijuana, and industrial hemp. Transcripts of 420 Radio News are available daily on our website at 420radio.org. Now, here's Russ Melville with your marijuana headlines in 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
This is your 420 Radio News for Wednesday, April 29th, 2015. Marijuana businesses could open bank accounts under legislation unveiled in the U.S. House today. The Marijuana Business Access to Banking Act, introduced late yesterday by Representative Ed Perlmutter, a Democrat of Colorado, would provide banks with so-called safe harbor so they can offer accounts to marijuana businesses without the threat of federal retaliation. Quote, first and foremost, this is an issue of public safety, Perlmutter said. Not only are the proprietors at risk, but the employees and customers are also at risk of serious and violent crimes, end quote. Medical marijuana is legal in 23 states and Washington, D.C., but banks are still prohibited from dealing with pot shops in those states. In addition to Perlmutter, Representative Denny Heck, a Democrat of Washington, and 16 other lawmakers are backing the legislation. Quote, forcing businesses into cash-only territory is a dangerous step away from legitimacy, transparency, and regulation, and a huge step toward crime, tax evasion, and access to minors, end quote, Heck said. A legislative panel gave its full backing to legislation yesterday that proposes authorizing legal dispensaries for medical marijuana in Louisiana. If the bill becomes law, medical marijuana would not be available in a smokable form. It would also be restricted for use by patients suffering from glaucoma, spastic quadriplegia, and for those undergoing chemotherapy treatment for cancer. The Louisiana legislature legalized marijuana for medical purposes in 1991, but there's no mechanism in current law that allows for the legal dispensing of the drug. Doctors can legally prescribe it, patients can legally use it, but they don't have a middleman. Senate Bill 143, sponsored by Senator Fred Mills, gives legal authority to the Louisiana Board of Pharmacy to set rules regulating a tightly constrained dispensary system. Mills negotiated with the Louisiana Sheriffs Association to get his bill in a posture that allowed the sheriffs to take a neutral stance on it. As the Nebraska legislature waits to begin first-round debate on a bill that would legalize medical marijuana, Governor Pete Ricketts sent a message Tuesday that signaled his intent if it passes. In a column headlined, "Marijuana is a Dangerous Drug," Ricketts said the medicinal virtues of marijuana are still much debated. Ricketts called legalization for any purpose a risky proposition, quote, "Marijuana remains a federally banned controlled substance whose medicinal value has not been tested," end quote, Ricketts said. The governor also attempted to tie K2, so-called synthetic marijuana tied to recent overdoses in Lincoln and Bellevue, into the discussion of medical marijuana. Yesterday, six Nebraskans met with Ricketts and Chief Medical Officer Dr. Joseph Asierno for a half an hour to plead their cases. They have children with severe epilepsy, a husband who died of brain cancer, or they themselves suffer from multiple sclerosis and chronic pain. The three largest Ohio branches of the union representing nearly 70,000 retail workers today endorsed the Responsible Ohio initiative to legalize marijuana. Quote, "The executive board of these locals, which are made up of rank-and-file members, made a decision to support this proposal because we want to make sure that we have good jobs in the new legal marijuana industry," end quote, said Lori Couch, a spokeswoman for United Food and Commercial Workers. The majority of the local members work in retail stores, Couch said, including Kroger, Meijer, and CVS, as well as in food packing and processing. The endorsement follows Monday's nod from Dr. Odell Owens, the president of Cincinnati State Technical and Community College. If passed, the proposal would create a marijuana control commission that would license 10 farms around the state, which the investors have already purchased, to grow the crop. Another 1,100 licenses would be issued for testing laboratories, manufacturing facilities, and retail outlets. More than 63% of the Michiganders who responded to a recent University of Michigan survey said that medical marijuana use is okay for adults, but 80% of the nearly 2,200 polled said it's not okay to use around children. The hospital poll on national health, which was administered during November and December, showed that even though 4 out of 5 people said medical marijuana should not be used by adults around kids, 36% of the respondents said children should be permitted to use marijuana for medicinal purposes. This has been your 420 Radio News for Wednesday, April 29th, 2015. I'm Russ Belville. Radio, your ticket to the High Times Cannabis Cups. The Fingerboard Extension has fretted instruments to enhance your creativity. It has new and used guitars and banjos from beginning to high class. The Fingerboard Extension has National Resophonic, Husson Dalton, Larrabee, Heritage and Recording King guitars, and Mike Ramsey, Wildwood, Gold Tone, and Recording King banjos. The Fingerboard Extension also has drum stuff, used gear, and parts. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension, downtown Corvallis, Oregon at 120 Northwest 2nd, or check out the inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com and reverb.com.
If you're an adult who enjoys a good beer, there's a similar product you might want to know about. One without all the calories and serious health problems. Less toxic so it doesn't cause hangovers or overdose deaths, and it's not linked to violence or reckless behavior. Marijuana. Less harmful than alcohol, and time to treat it that way. For more information, visit marijuanaissafer.org.
Oregon has joined Washington and Colorado in legalizing marijuana. We're Portland Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws chapter in Portland, Oregon. Join us as we celebrate the launch of an exciting new era in marijuana freedom in Oregon. Our job has just begun. Powerful interests want to white out the most important portions of Oregon's legalization law. By joining Portland Normal, you add your voice to the thousands who voted for Measure 91 and want it to be implemented as written. The people have spoken. Now it is time for the legislature to obey the will of the people. Find out more about Portland Normal at portlandnormal.org. Attend our monthly membership meetings on the fourth Saturday of the month. See our website for more details. Portland Normal. Ensuring responsible adult marijuana consumers are afforded the same rights, privileges, and responsibilities as beer drinkers.
Welcome back, everyone. 14 after the hour, and here in the state of Oregon, we are working on the implementation of Measure 91, our initiative to legalize marijuana. And despite the fact that three times in that initiative it said it wouldn't do anything to affect the Oregon medical marijuana program, the legislature seems hell-bent on affecting the Oregon medical marijuana program. They first attempted these changes through a bill that was called Senate Bill 936. We showed up in protest against that, testifying against that with two overflow rooms that were standing room only in addition to the hearing room. They backed off of that, but then last Friday introduced some amendments to a different bill that was Senate Bill 844. And the tale of this can kind of give you a glimpse into why some people don't get involved in politics, think it's all rigged, don't want to participate. And for that matter, it's too complex sometimes for people to follow. So let me just give you a look at this. First of all, this Senate Bill 844 is a pretty simple bill. I'm looking at it right now. It's 14 lines long. It's, you know, it's not any big change. It basically says a licensed premise, that being a medical marijuana dispensary, right? A licensed premises may receive marijuana items only from a marijuana producer, processor, or wholesaler for whom a premises has been licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This was basically saying the existing medical marijuana facilities can no longer just get their weed from medical marijuana growers. They have to get them for someone who's been licensed by the OLCC. But in and of itself, that's a fairly small bill. That's one particular position. You could be for or against that. But then they start amending this thing, and they put these amendments in Friday, late in the day, and they were called the -6 amendments. That means there were 5 previous amendments that were attached to this, but we're going to join the story at -6 because this is the one that's got everyone freaking out. The -6 amendments would make it so that the medical marijuana growers who are currently allowed to grow 6 plants per patient they serve would be subject to some brand new requirements of record keeping for up to 7 years, including the number of mature plants and immature plants in their possession, who they've transferred to them, how much they got transferred to dispensaries, and so forth, to submit this information once a month, and then to keep these records on hand for 7 years. So people that were hobby marijuana growers, people who already have jobs, already have lives, in addition to growing some medical marijuana for some people to help them out, now are expected to become bookkeepers, accountants, record keepers, filing clerks, and so forth. I tell you, this is not going to work. Most people who grow medical will just ignore this and go back to doing it kind of on the sly like they used to. But as if that wasn't bad enough, the other thing that's included in these -6 amendments are some limitations on how many patients these people could serve. If you were a medical marijuana growing for someone and you lived in a city limits, you would be restricted to having just 12 plants at your grow site. That is, you could only serve 2 patients. If you were outside of city limits, you could have up to 4. You could have up to 24 plants in these circumstances. So the medical marijuana community is rebelling against this because, according to the state's own statistics, there are over 5,000 patients who get their marijuana from a garden that supplies more than 2 patients. So you're asking someone who's growing in a city who might be growing for 4, 5, 6 people to choose which of those 2 people they're going to continue to serve and which of those 2, 3, or 4 cancer, AIDS, MS patients are going to have to do without. So everybody's rebelling against that. And if that wasn't bad enough, you get this -6 amendment that everybody gets late on a Friday and scrambles to try to make sense of for the upcoming work sessions that happened on Monday, and then there's one happening tonight. Then they go and add more amendments. This latest amendment is -7 amendment, and it's in this one, it's got a whole bunch of these things on this page, delete these words and put in these new words. In this one, delete the comma and put in a semicolon. In this one, delete the letter D and put in the letter C and so forth. So it's, you have to go back to the original document to figure out what the hell they're even talking about. But at least in the -7 amendments, they're saying on page 23, line 24, delete at least 7 and insert 2. Now, if you go back and read the page 23, line 24, you eventually find out that that was the part that said that these growers have to keep 7 years worth of records. And this would change it to 2 years worth of records. So better. But how would anyone know that that amendment's in there or what it refers to unless they were able to, like me, take the time to read through all this stuff and figure out all these different amendments? There's a -9 amendment that has a whole bunch of, on line 23, delete the colon and insert a comma. There's a -10 amendment that adds that a governing body of a city or county may adopt ordinances that prohibit the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries or processing sites. So now we're going to add in this power for localities to ban medical marijuana. There's a Dash 11 amendment that has to do with the transfer of cannabinoids and developing the database to track all these people. There's a Dash 12 amendment that has more of this, take out the word use and put in the word comma.
You're really clouding the energy in this room right now.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that's how it really feels when you're trying to parse this stuff. And I'm a guy who reads these bills day after day, who has contact with the people in the know that I can ask if I have a question. How's the average citizen supposed to parse their way through all that and figure out who or what to vote for and who and what to support? No wonder people are turned off on politics.
420 Radio, turning red states and blue states green.
Yeah, come to the weed shop. Yeah, that's where we shop. Shop at weedshop.com. Come to the weed shop. Yeah, that's where we shop. Shop at weedshop.com. Whether it's a vape pen, a pipe, or a bong, you can find it right now on weedshop.com. We got dab rings, nails, and ship it fast. Whipping any of a competitor's glass. Come to the weed shop. Yeah, that's where we shop. Shop at weedshop.com. Come to the weed shop. Yeah, that's where we shop. Shop at weedshop.com.
Hey, this is Big Daddy, and I want you to know it's never too late to join me at the Funky Roller Rink every Thursday night, right here on 420 Radio.
Funky Roller Rink.
I like it like that.
Get .buzz. .buzz is the internet platform that fuels community interest, excitement, and new experiences. .buzz is the premier online destination for internet users seeking the latest news on a variety of topics. .buzz appeals to groups active in blogging, communications, journalism, advertising, and marketing. .buzz offers registrants a stronger alternative to the shrinking namespace of existing top-level domain names, such as .com, .net, and .org. Get your name now at get.buzz.
Arguing for the end of adult marijuana prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It is even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more in this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Welcome back, everyone. 23 after the hour. Today, we're taking a look at an article on Forbes.com written by Arthur Kane, and it addresses addresses something that I've ranted about many times, and that is what I call the infantilization of the poor. This idea that we need to control each and every aspect of the poor's life, people in poverty's lives, if we are giving them any sort of welfare. And so in this debate, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not people are using welfare money, you know, TANF benefits, cash benefits with their cards, and withdrawing that money at pot shops in Colorado to buy weed. And so the Washington Post Wonk blog addressed this, the Associated Press addressed this, called it an urban legend. And this article purports that it's not. The title is Welfare Money Being Used for Pot? That's No Urban Legend. And he did some reporting on this and actually did some public records requests and found out some information. And despite my feelings about this, it is important that we discuss the issue with the facts in hand. So that's why I bring this to you. In Colorado, where I work, he writes, food stamp recipients withdrew hundreds of thousands of dollars each year at ATMs in casinos, liquor stores, and pot shops. And he did an open records request to Colorado's Human Services Department and found that in 2014, there were 416 ATM transactions at five Colorado casinos totaling more than $36,000 and 163 transactions totaling nearly $29,000 at pot shops. So there have been people withdrawing money at pot shops, casinos, and liquor stores from their welfare cash benefits. He also reports that $340,000 was withdrawn in Colorado liquor stores over the past 2 years, and some of the people on welfare withdrew some of their money while in Vegas, Hawaii, or the Virgin Islands. Now, he does point out that it's a small, small percentage of $200 million that is handed out in Colorado for these welfare cash benefits, but it's not nothing. And this has been found in other other states as well. And some folks want to try to dismiss this, you know, by saying, no, they could be withdrawing the money for formula or something. Yeah, right. At the pot shop, I doubt it. But here's what I want to get to. And the point is, how far do we want to go? Okay. So someone withdrew money at the pot shop. They're on welfare and they withdrew money at the pot shop. Now, unlike withdrawing the money at the casino, where you could say that's purely an entertainment expense, or at the liquor store, where you could say it's purely an entertainment expense, marijuana might be one of the better things that these people could be purchasing. It might be fulfilling many other purposes, from sleep deprivation to pain relief. There's all sorts of medicinal reasons people might use marijuana that don't fall under the umbrella of the severe disability, you know, typical medical marijuana patient, headaches and so forth. So maybe they do spend some money at the pot shop and get some weed, but if they weren't, would they have just spent that money instead on alcohol, on aspirin, on Ambien, on whatever else they might be substituting marijuana for? But let's even take those cases aside and let's pretend that, yeah, those pot shop withdrawals were like the liquor store withdrawals or the casino withdrawals. They were just withdrawing them for entertainment purposes only. Is it our stance here that poor people don't get entertainment? That they should be suffering at all times? Do you know how stressful it is to be poor? How much of a toll it takes on your mental health? I can definitely tell you about that from the perspective of a child who grew up in poverty, as an adult who has lived in poverty. It's rough. So if we're going to stop them from withdrawing money at a casino or a pot shop or a liquor store, where does it end? Do we make it so we give them cards that are like ATM cards, but they're coded based on barcodes, so that when you are ringing things up at the grocery, you know, like food stamps are, kind of, right? You can't ring up, you know, cigarettes on food stamps, right? But similar with the cash benefits, we no longer give people on welfare any freedom to decide what they're doing with their benefit, even the freedom to make a bad choice, to make a stupid decision. We're going to take that freedom away. What's going to be on the list of things they can buy? Can poor people no longer buy steaks or seafood? Can poor people no longer buy Coca-Cola? They can only buy the Shasta knockoff for 69 cents. Can the poor people who are seeking entertainment no longer go to the movies or rent something from a Redbox? Should we make it so that the only thing poor people get is the bare sustenance food they need? Hell, can they spend their money on clothes? Are poor people allowed to buy clothes, or should they only be allowed to wear a gray jumpsuit, a cheap gray jumpsuit, right? That way we can identify them. We can pick them out in a crowd and know exactly who they are, right? So we can treat them the way we feel our peasant serfs ought to be treated. Folks, if we're going to be a free country, we're going to have to accept that at some level, people are going to make bad decisions, and that we have to grant them the freedom to make those bad decisions, even if they're poor, even if they're doing it with our money. I'm not trying to endorse fraud or waste, but we need to know where we're drawing the line here.
420 Radio. Tune in, turn on, get high, Lee-educated.
Growing plants indoors can be a rewarding hobby, but electricity bills can go through the roof. Then you have to cool down all those big hot lights. It can drive a grower insane. With Lush LED lighting, you can solve many of these issues and double your rewards. Matt and his scientists have developed the perfect light for flowering plants with far less cost and heat. And the results? Very effective. Check out LushLEDLighting.com right now and tell them Radical Russ sent you.
NARML stands for Responsible Adult Cannabis Use. If cannabis use is causing problems in your life, consider taking a break or seeking medical assistance. Consider ceasing cannabis use if you have a family history of mental illness. Don't drive or operate heavy machinery while impaired by cannabis use. Cannabis use is not without risks, even though the risks may be far less than those posed by legal drugs.
Hey everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
The cannabis community is a diverse set of people from all walks of life, conservative and liberal, black and white, straight and gay, rich and poor, and everyone in between. Learn more about the people we are freeing from adult marijuana prohibition in our cannabis community chat.
Welcome back, everyone. 31 after the hour, and we go just north of me to Vancouver, British Columbia, where we've got Jamie Shaw on the line from Vancouver's BC Compassion Club. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, such perfect timing having you on the show as well, because just yesterday I was telling folks the news story about the city of Vancouver and how the Canadian federal government is not too happy with you guys trying to make your own rules about marijuana. Can you give us an insider's perspective on what's going on there in Vancouver?
It's true. Yeah, I will do my best, although it's a big, complicated picture. Basically, the BC Compassion Club Society, we were founded in 97, and we were the only dispensary in Vancouver for a little while. By 2001, the federal government was ordered to create a medical marijuana exemption program. Ever since, they've been doing the bare minimum and leading to a lot of constitutional challenges. And the city of Vancouver finally got tired of it after 14 years and decided that they needed to regulate the dispensary business. In the last 2 years, we've seen growth from 10 to 80 dispensaries, so they had to move quickly.
Wow. So the city of Vancouver is just kind of not just turning a blind eye to the fact that dispensaries are popping up, kind of like, you know, what happened with Washington State. They were kind of quasi-legal, and they popped up, and everyone just kind of let it happen. But Vancouver's being proactive here and actually coming up with the regulations themselves, and the results sound like they've been pretty positive.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's some issues around certain things, like not being allowed to distribute edibles, but that's actually at the Supreme Court right now, being decided by the Supreme Court judges, so we can see that changing on that level soon. And yeah, Vancouver's really doing what San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley did a long time ago. In Canada, our cities don't really have those powers, so it took a little bit longer, but they're now doing it anyway.
Yeah, that's something I want to talk about. Before we get off that issue, what's the issue with edibles under Health Canada and the medical marijuana program?
Well, when they designed the program 2 years ago, they decided it was going to be just big corporate producers. They would license about 25 to 50 of them, and they would supply everybody, but they would only be allowed to supply dried cannabis, so no extracts, no oils, no edibles. And that obviously does not work for an awful lot of patients, particularly some of the ones with the worst health conditions.
Sure.
Simply can't smoke. So that is an issue. But it went all the way to the Supreme Court in R versus Smith, and we should be having a decision in that within a couple of months.
Oh, wow. And so the dispensaries in Vancouver, I assume, are providing these edible products to people.
Absolutely. We always have been. Yeah.
Sure. All
right. Tinctures and various forms.
Now, in the United States here, when Berkeley and Oakland and these other places started allowing these things to happen, the heavy hand of the federal government came down in the form of these U.S. attorneys. Has there been a similar reaction in British Columbia to try to tamp this down? Any raids or anything?
Not really. There's been hype. They were not happy, but...
You Canadians are so polite.
Right. Well, and I think part of it is if they waited too long. I mean, if they had done that a long time ago, maybe they would have managed to scare people into keeping it all underground. You still wouldn't have stopped people from supplying cannabis to patients that needed it. That was never going to happen. That's ultimately what San Francisco realized a very long time ago. Vancouver did too, and issued very progressive drug policies, but the federal government's been fighting them on every level. We've got a supervised injection site here that people from all over the world come to look at that injection site and develop practices in their own countries for that. And yet our own federal government doesn't recognize it and is doing everything they can to stop it. And it's the same with medical cannabis.
And this is this still just, you know, Stephen Harper's government, their hatred of all things marijuana? And what's going to take to change that? Is there any election or anything that's going to change that anytime soon?
There is an election coming up soon, and also part of this whole Vancouver process is going to involve public hearings. So the citizens of Vancouver will get to voice their concerns with the regulations, and a lot of them don't really understand why there's certain things that Vancouver couldn't do, such as edibles and things like that. And so I think once the public's voice is heard on this, that is going to help things move along as well. And there's a court case not only for edibles, but there's another court case and the federal court to decide the right to personal growing. So there are a lot of different fronts right now where we've finally gotten the right people to look at the evidence, and hopefully they'll come back with logical conclusions. And we do have an election coming up in the fall.
All right. We're speaking with Jamie Shaw from Vancouver, British Columbia's BC Compassion Club. And one of the interesting things, Jamie, about the place we find ourselves in now is that it used to be just about, you know, arguing for whether or not it's legal, whether or not we not get busted and arrested and incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Now, arguments in our community are centered around some of the business aspects of these regulations. And I have a Canadian in my chat room who's complaining about the licensing cost of $30,000 Canadian to get involved with this. What can you tell us about those costs and any controversies about those costs that you've heard from people?
Well, it is a significantly higher than other licenses in the city, although there are other, like if you own a liquor store, for example, the license is a little bit less, but there's other fees and other licensing and things that you have to pay. But we're also looking at that this is a brand new program, and we're really hoping that they specifically look at the nonprofits and the dispensaries that have really given back to the community over the last couple decades. And give them a break on that licensing fee. And the city themselves have also said that they're looking at scaling that back once they've kind of figured out what it's going to cost them to implement this.
All right. Now, of course, all of this is in discussion about medical marijuana in Vancouver and British Columbia in general. But we're also looking at legalization that's spreading all across the West here in the United States. And, you know, we've kind of got you surrounded now. We got Alaska on one side. We got Washington and Oregon below you. What are the prospects for recreational legalization in BC and Canada?
Well, looking at these regulations, we found it very interesting that they specifically looked at Washington and Colorado for the models. Mm-hmm. And there's not much medical in the language around these regulations. So this model could work for either recreational or medicinal. And we do have a political party running in the fall. There's three main parties. One of them wants to continue the drug war that most everyone else in the free world has realized doesn't work. We've got one that wants to legalize, and we've got one that wants to decriminalize, so basically fines. So it's going to be interesting to see how much of a role that actually plays in the election. And, yeah, it's really, honestly, people in D.C. were a little upset because, you know, that was kind of our thing.
Well, legalization was kind of your thing and the thunder
well,
got stolen?
Well, cannabis was kind of our thing, right? You know, BC Bud's kind of famous everywhere. So the fact that you guys all now have it legal and we're still risking arrest every day, not fair.
Yeah, we'll work hard to get that changed. I want the whole Cascadia region to be the most legal place on earth. I think that'd be a beautiful thing.
It absolutely would be.
Now, as far as the medical program in Canada, the last time I did any research and reporting on this, they were still growing marijuana in a mine. There was all sorts of problems with the federal system. Any updates on that? Has it gotten any better on the federal level?
Well, yes and no. That company is still growing, but under a different name and no longer in a mine.
Well, that's good.
But basically, that's another kind of really odd thing about the regulations that the federal government has, is that it's very much massive corporate grows, focusing really only on percentages of THC and CBD and not really looking at it as a whole plant medicine, mm-hmm. and not really looking at what pesticides they're putting on it. I mean, they're being very careful. They're looking at ones that are safe for herbal ingestion, for example, but studies haven't really been done on whether those can be smoked or not. And we know a lot of people, like our growers, for example, use natural predators and organic fertilizers and things that are a lot more holistic when you're trying to grow medicine. I mean, we're talking about a living thing here, right? It's not really a product.
And I guess then part of the point of what Vancouver's trying to do is to recognize those aspects that are lacking in the federal system, to keep it at the smaller grow level, the human-tended plants with some care and some understanding of what's going on with the whole plant medicine then.
Well, I think that's what the people are doing, frankly. I mean, this explosion of growth happened after the federal government announced their program and was trying to institute it. So people were fine with 4 or 5 dispensaries here for 15 years. And then once people saw what the legal system, what the federal government was offering, the dispensaries have just popped up, not just in Vancouver, all across Canada. We've seen pretty major growth, but we already had a lot concentrated in BC, so it's more obvious here.
Yeah, and of course, the legendary BC Bud, everybody knows about that. Jamie Shaw from Vancouver's BC Compassion Club, before we run out of time, I want to make sure that people know how to get in touch with you online or find more information about what you're up to or how to get involved. Can you give them some contacts?
Absolutely. It's www.thecompassionclub.org. And I'm also the president of the Canadian Association of Medical Cannabis Dispensaries, which is camcd.ca.
All right. Looking forward to that. And, I imagine that, for the longest time, it was so weird. It seemed to us that Canada wanted to legalize weed, and we were the anti-pot, United States kind of threatening trade sanctions and things if you dared to do such a thing. Now it almost seems like the positions have reversed. Here we are legalizing 4 states already, looking at another 4 or 5 in the next couple of years. And Canada's resisting that. But at what point does our lack of pressure against Canada internationally start to translate into change in Canada's policies?
Well, it's strange because that has always been the excuse. And the government a long time ago with the Levine Report wanted to legalize and always blamed you guys for why we couldn't. Yeah. And that hasn't been an excuse for a long time, but I think our current government explains that. And it's not, this isn't the only policy area where you guys have really moved forward in an area where we used to be pretty forward and aren't so much anymore.
Well, it's interesting to watch from afar, and I've got to get up to Vancouver. There's a train that runs right from Portland. I'll make my way up there and give you all a visit.
Very nice. Absolutely.
All right. Jamie Shaw from Vancouver's BC Compassion Club, thank you so much for joining us here on the Russ Belville Show, and good luck on everything there in Canada, the Vancouver regulations. I really love seeing a city stand up against a federal government like that. Oakland and Berkeley, they did a lot. Seattle did a lot to move the national conversation forward. I think Vancouver can do the same. Thanks for all the hard work you're doing.
Thank you, Russ.
All right. We're going to continue on. We've got another Radical Rant coming up next on the show. Of course, here in the United States, all eyes are on the city of Baltimore, which has erupted into civil unrest, strife, violence, looting, chaos, burning, over what has become far too common here in this country, and that is the death of an unarmed black man at the hands of police. We're going to explain why you cannot even begin to address that until you end the war on drugs. 43 After. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio, the world's voice of marijuana legalization. At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs, and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics, Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of The Russ Belville Show and 420 Radio.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
The Russ Belville Show reminds you to never smoke and drive impaired. Hang out for a while. Share.
You know Herb Thrasher from the Herb Thrasher Flower Hour. Now get ready for Herb Age Designs for the proud cannabis consumer. Herb Age Designs, lifestyle gear for the 420 friendly. Herb Age Designs, we've got frisbee golf discs and durable hemp gear. Herb Age Designs, we've got shot glasses, drinking glasses, coffee mugs, and beer cozies. Check us out on Facebook and online at herbagedesigns.com. And follow Herb Age and Herb Thrasher on Twitter.
We must wage what I have called total war against public enemy number one.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
That marijuana, pot, grass, whatever you want to call it, is probably the most dangerous drug.
Some think there won't be room for them in jail. We'll make room.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
Entirely legitimate topic for debate.
Radical Rant.
Welcome back, everyone. 46 after the hour, and feels like deja vu all over again. Seems like I was just talking about this subject when Ferguson erupted. Ferguson, Missouri, erupted in protests over another death, more deaths of black men being killed by police. And in response to that, I wrote an article for High Times Magazine, showed up in the print edition. And I originally titled it, "To Get Beyond Racism, We Need to Legalize Drugs." And I think the High Times staff retitled it Prohibition, the Child of the Drug War, something like that. But the gist of the article was that the drug war is the means by which Jim Crow evolved. The means by which the patriarchal white society could maintain a system of privilege for white people and systematically harass, control, corral, arrest, disenfranchise, and even kill black folks. Didn't have to have signs anymore, though. You didn't have to have a whites-only sign. You didn't have to have a no-colored sign anymore. Just got codified into law. Now, this new Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander so rightfully called it, is built off of a racist ideology in the first place. We know, and you've heard me mention this many times, how the prohibitions on drugs in this country began in the early 20th century as racist reactions to the incursions, the perceived incursions, of immigrants in this country. Whether it was Chinese on the West Coast building the railroads, whether it was the Irish coming into New York taking the jobs, whether it was the Latin Americans, Mexicans coming into the South, whether it was the blacks who were newly enfranchised and freed and able to participate in society. It was always them and their drugs. And I don't exaggerate on this. Things like the first bans on opium didn't ban opium. They banned Chinese people from running opium dens. Okay, so, I mean, there's a definite racist history to this. But beyond that, the drug war became the mechanism by which this racism is enforced, where this American racism continues to fester. And I wrote this piece for High Times, and I got a lot of good comments for it, but I felt a little weird writing it in that, you know, number one, I am that white privilege. I am that stereotypical white guy. Why am I the one writing this? And number two, that it should have to be written. That
trying to explain that the drug war is our tool of racism and oppression seems so self-evident, so incredibly obvious to me that I actually had to sit down and think about writing the piece. Like, this needs to be explained. There are people that don't understand this. Well, today, as I'm catching up on the news and reading through various websites, I find that my voice, my perspective on this is beginning to be echoed by the people in the halls of power. And, you know, I'm not saying that I influence, like they're tuning into me and I convinced them or anything. I'm just saying that the way I've been thinking and a lot of you have been thinking about this drug war is becoming the dominant mode of thought about the drug war. We are winning the hearts and minds in this drug war. First story that brought this up to me was Elise Foley writing in Huffington Post. Title of the story, legislators say marijuana reform could ease tensions in Baltimore and beyond. This was posted just today. And it refers to that press conference that announced that banking act that we covered in the news, this access to banking for the legal states. But the lawmakers, on their own accord, tied this whole reform movement together. Remember, we're just talking about them announcing a bill to allow legal pot shops to do banking, right? They didn't have to come out and expound on that any further, but they did. Representative Dana Rohrabacher from California, from Orange County, a conservative guy, says, quote, "Right now, when you see all of this disturbance in our inner cities, a lot of that has to do with frustration that's been a problem when police end up doing what? Having to search people to see if they can find some joint in their pocket, a little piece of weed, in order to ruin their life and put them in jail? This doesn't happen a lot in Orange County, but I know it happens in the inner city." End quote. And the Post goes on to talk about, give us some other quotes. Neil Franklin from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, who worked with the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore Police Department and has been a guest on our show numerous times, said, quote, "The drug war is central to what's going on in Baltimore. We have tasked our police officers with an impossible job of enforcing these drug laws in our country. But it's not just impossible, it's disheartening. It's a job where there is no progress." Very important point there. Earl Blumenauer, my congressman, says, quote, "There are highly discriminatory patterns of enforcement that are a major problem in cities. For lower-income minority young men, an arrest or incarceration can be devastating. If you're a middle-class white kid, you probably wouldn't have been arrested in the first place, and your parents can get you off. A young minority male is more likely to have this wreck their lives. Lose qualification for student loans. If they live in public housing, they may not be able to live with their family. And this compounds." And Representative Ruben Gallego from Arizona said, quote, "I do believe it would help. It doesn't solve the problems that inner city youth have, because that's long-term problems, dealing with unemployment, institutional racism, all those kinds of things. But it does help, I think, negate at least a little and also bring down the tension between police officers and young men," unquote. So they're getting it. They're beginning to get it. That the drug war is the tool, the key that unlocks our constitutional protections. It's the tool that the occupying police force gets to use to justify any incursion into the liberties of the citizens they're patrolling. And I'm posting a link to this other story. And this one hit the nail so firmly on the head, it drove it right through the 2x4 in one stroke. It's David Simon. You know David Simon, he's the guy who produced The Wire, remember? He was the executive producer of The Wire on HBO. Before that, he worked at the Baltimore Sun for a dozen years. So this guy knows Baltimore in and out. This article on the Marshall Project just nails it. It's a question and answer. And he just completely nails the fact. And he says right here, "Probable cause was destroyed by the drug war. It happened in stages, but even in the time that I was a police reporter, which would have been the early 80s to early 90s, the need for police officers to address the basic rights of the people they were policing in Baltimore was minimized." He says, if I had to guess and put a name on it, I'd say that at some point the drug war was as much a function of class and social control as it was of racism. And he points out the city instituting drug-free zones where merely standing someplace in public could get you netted up in a sweep, put into jail. And he goes on to say, what the drug war did, though, was make this all a function of societal control. This was simply about keeping the poor down, and that war footing has been an excuse for everybody to operate outside the realm of procedure and law. And the city willingly and legally gave itself over to that, beginning with the drug-free zones and the misuse of what are known on the street in the previous generation as humbles. A humble is a cheap, inconsequential arrest that nonetheless gives the guy a night or two in jail before he sees a court commissioner. You can arrest people for failure to obey. It's a humble. Loitering is a humble. These things were used by police officers going back to the 60s in Baltimore. It's the ultimate recourse for a cop who doesn't like somebody who's looking at him the wrong way. And yet, back in the day, there was, I think, more of a code to it. If you were on the corner, you knew certain things would catch you a humble. The code was really ornate, and I'm not suggesting in any way that the code was always justifiable, but there was a code. And it's interesting. He explains how if you were told to clear off the corner and you called the cop a motherfucker, you'd probably get away with it. But if you called him an asshole, you'd get a humble. That's how weird the code was, right? So he discusses how the drug war systematically corrupted cops that were looking for simple and easy arrests. He explains how the method by which a cop moves forward and progresses his career is directly tied to how many of these arrests that they can pile up. So you'd have a good cop. Say you got a good cop who's working his ass off trying to figure out who's behind a series of burglaries in a neighborhood, spends all month on the case, building leads, tracking down evidence, and so forth, finally nails the guy, arrests him on a clean warrant, gets him busted, and does real police work, takes a guy off the streets who's causing harm to other people and their property. Well, as far as the stats go, that's one cop getting one arrest. And all that time that he's spending looking up the evidence and tracking down the leads and calling people and beating feet on the street, man, all that time is just regular old time that he's getting paid for. Meanwhile, you get the other cop who knows that he can round up a bunch of kids on humbles, can round them up for having weed in their pocket or smelling like weed or looking at them the wrong way. Why, that cop, he might rack up 80 arrests in that month. And then those arrests, they got to go to court. And when you go to court, it's always overtime. You always get paid overtime for going to court. So you get this other cop who's not doing anything to make the streets of Baltimore any safer and making them more dangerous by eroding the level of trust between all of those young black men who get arrested and picked up for essentially doing nothing. And they end up resenting the cops. And it sets up this feedback loop. So it's not only not taking the burglar off the street, but it's also pissing off a whole bunch of regular old citizens who might not otherwise be any sort of problem. And that cop gets rewarded. Because when it comes time for promotions, they look at the stats and they say, hey, well, look at SuperCop here. SuperCop here made 80 arrests. That cop over there that got the burglar, yeah, he got a burglar. We got one guy. And when that comes down to things like, and he goes on to talk about Martin O'Malley, who was the mayor of Baltimore, who did some police reforms, but in the end, eventually succumbed to the need to produce statistics that matched his predictions of how he'd be law and order and tough on crime, because he's a politician aiming for the governor's office. And so none of this gets untangled until you can take away that incentive, that tool, that easy arrest that the cops in Baltimore get out of the drug war. And yes, that representative from Arizona is absolutely right. There are bigger fish to fry. There are instances of institutional racism. There are, you know, decades long lack of wealth in the black community. There's, you know, unemployment. There's just flat out racism. And legalizing is not going to solve any of those things. But we can't begin to solve those things so long as we're under the oppressive thumb of drug laws that eviscerate our constitutional rights. That's all the time we got for this first hour. Stay tuned to hour two. We'll talk more about it. But until next time, I'm Radical Russ. Take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.